Let's get started, Scott, with what has happened to you last week. We were going to talk at that particular day, but you didn't appear. And what's going on right now? What are the latest information on that case?
Well, there's nothing. The latest is nothing. The FBI executed a search warrant on the day we were supposed to have our interview, and unfortunately, the computer that I was going to use to have that interview in the time period that we were scheduled to do were no longer available. The computer is in the possession of the FBI, who had a search warrant authorizing them to seize the computer. And I was detained in my living room being questioned by a pair of FBI agents. Both the seizure of the computer and the nature of the questioning of the FBI agents is related to what they said is concern on the part of the U.S. government that I am operating in violation of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, FARA, and that they believe that I am acting as a foreign agent on behalf of the Russian government. And so that's that. I told them in no uncertain terms that not only was this not the case, but they damn sure aren't going to find anything on my computer and phone and electronics that would substantiate that, because it just simply isn't the case. I think they were looking for evidence of communications, maybe covert communications that they hadn't been able to detect using other means. And the only way they felt that they could get access to this information was to execute this search warrant. So now they have the computers, now they have the phone, and now they're wasting U.S. taxpayer dollars, because they're going to be scanning this in, and they're going to have technicians going through painstaking detail, looking, at every text I've sent, every email I've sent, every text I've received. I would imagine when they come up with nothing there, they're going to say, well, he's got to be communicating covertly. Let's go through every image in his phone and his computer to make sure there's not, embedded, pixelated, stenographic communication means, spy versus spy stuff, where I take a photograph and take a pixel and blow it up, and there's my hidden orders from the Russian government, and then I have a special camera and I take a picture and I pixelate it down, and I have software on my phone that enables me to embed it in a picture, and then I put the picture on the internet and everybody goes, oh, look, Scott's drinking vodka with the Russian officers, but the Russian SVR is going, no, that's the secret photograph. And they pull it out and they explode it up and they take the little image out and they blow it up. And oh, there's all the information Scott Ritter wanted to give. Good luck, guys. You've been reading too many spy novels. I mean, look, the Russians do use that. There's a well-known case in New York City where that's, the way the Russian intelligence service communicate. So I'm not saying that the FBI doesn't have any experience in this. I'm not saying that they couldn't think that this was happening. I mean, I wish they didn't, but it's not happening, and they're going to find that out. And then the question is, what do they do next? Because you have to ask the question, why did you do this? Why did you initiate this action? Somebody somewhere made an affidavit that was presented to a judge that established probable cause to carry out this search. I'd like to know what's in that affidavit. And I certainly hope that when the search comes back negative to the judge who signed off on the search warrant, because that's the judge's responsibility to follow through. Hey, I put my signature on that search warrant. What did you find? Nothing. Then why the hell did you come before my office? That's the first question should be asked by the judge. You found nothing? Then what the hell were you doing presenting probable cause affidavits? Because clearly there wasn't probable cause. I certainly hope this kind of conversation takes place, because this is bull. I'm an American citizen. I have a free speech right. I'm a journalist. I have a right to participate in a free press. And what the FBI has done here in executing the search warrant the way they did has a chilling impact, whether they intended it to or not. I'm not going to get into their minds at this point. I have to say that the FBI agents who executed the search warrant were extraordinarily professional, very courteous. They did their jobs professionally. But this was not a hostile action. I mean, as unhostile as sending 20 heavily armed agents into your house, ripping it apart, can be. But, they were polite. They were courteous. Where they had questions, they asked the questions. They spent 5 hours talking to me. I had hoped that maybe my answers, because I was fully cooperative. And I told them that. I said, make sure that's in your report. fully cooperative. It's because at some point in time, a judge is going to have to review this and say, why the hell did you do this to me? Because I am an American citizen. I do have rights. And the concept of probable cause, I mean, what was your probable cause? Your suspicion isn't sufficient. And to say that because I was writing articles that they weren't happy about, because I attended functions at the Russian embassy, because I traveled to Russia, is insufficient, because none of that is illegal. None of the individual actions are illegal. And even if you bring them all together in their totality, they're not illegal. I have to be a Russian agent, receive direction from the Russian government or an individual operating on behalf of the Russian government. Direction, that means they're telling me what to do. That means I'm under the control of the Russian government. Now, Nima, you've known me for a little while. Do you think I'm under the control of anybody other than my wife? Do you think there's a person or an entity or an organization out there that control me? Do you understand I'm an American citizen, and I'm the worst kind of American citizen? I am the ugly American because I actually believe that I have rights. I actually believe in the power of the individual. I actually believe in the duty and responsibility of every American to hold their government accountable if we think that the government's doing something in our name that doesn't reflect the values and principles and beliefs, doesn't reflect the Constitution. It's not unpatriotic to criticize your government. It's the most patriotic act there is. And if you think for one second that a foreign government can control me, you're higher than a kite. And if you think the Russians can control me, I mean, I like the Russians, but, you know, I went over and did an interview with, Vladimir Solovyov, the head of Solovyov-Zai, big, you know, pro-Russian on-air host, very popular. And he asked me a question, but the insinuation was that I was pro-Russian. And I cut him off. I said, no, I'm not pro-Russian. I'm pro-American. I just happen to believe that good relations with the Russians is the way to prevent a nuclear war. And that's good for America. So I believe in, but I'm not pro-Russian. I'm not here acting on behalf of Russia. I like Russians. I enjoy meeting them. I enjoy their culture. I respect them. I'm friends with many of them. I'd like to be friends with more. I'm not pro-Russian. I'm pro-American. I just think that having good relations with Russia is the best thing for America. Apparently, somebody in the FBI, somebody in the Department of Justice, somebody in the Department of State, somebody in the U.S. government disagrees, or worse. And here's where it gets interesting. Or somebody in Ukraine disagrees. And we know that Ukraine disagrees. I'm on death lists. They have me on watch lists. They call me an information terrorist. They call me a Russian propagandist. They call me a foreign agent of Russia. The Ukrainians do this. And sadly, Ukraine has a history of reporting to the FBI, the same people, by the way, who raided my house, and saying, we're not happy with these Americans. And the FBI has a history of acting on that. They've shut down the Twitter accounts of American citizens because the Ukrainian government is now, that's not me making it up. The House Judiciary Committee of the United States Congress has found this in their report and their investigation. The FBI took orders, instructions from Ukrainian intelligence to shut down the social media accounts of American citizens, and they did it. The FBI intervened. I mean, what happened to the Constitution there, FBI? What happened to free speech there, FBI? Apparently, it's inconvenient. But the we also know that the State Department funded and organized and was the brains behind the Center for Countering Disinformation, an organization created under the auspices of the Presidency of Ukraine. So it's a Ukrainian outfit, paid for by the American taxpayer, organized by the American State Department, whose work is supervised by the American State Department. And we know that the very first thing they did upon being created was to issue what they call a blacklist. On that blacklist are American citizens, me included, who they say are information terrorists. Information terrorists is the word they use. And that's not slight of the word, because according to Ukrainians, and again, these are Ukrainians who are in an organization paid for and created by the American taxpayer, sponsored and supervised by the State Department, that these information terrorists need to be treated as terrorists in every way. Arrested, killed. And the U.S. government doesn't say anything to stop it. There are many Americans on that list, myself included. This Center for Countering Disinformation used to run a, basically a weekly and monthly report card. Who's the most dangerous information terrorist out there? The number one bad guy in the world, and yours truly, often featured as the number one bad guy in the world. I am the most dangerous information terrorist in the world today because apparently I'm a Russian agent and I promulgate nothing but Russian propaganda. And they put that out there in the State Department. Who pays them, who makes this happen, who probably helped do that, does nothing about it. So I'm a little bit concerned that the raid that took place on my house didn't come because of some misunderstanding or miscomprehension within the U.S. government. It came because the U.S. government buckled under the pressure put on it by the Ukrainian government to shut down my voice. And that's a big problem. I mean, the other one's a big problem too, but this is an even bigger problem. And the irony is the FBI is coming at me saying, we think you're an agent of a foreign government. And yet the FBI is the only one taking orders and direction from a foreign intelligence service to shut down the free speech of an American. So who knows what's happening? They have my computers, they have my phone, they have other electronics. Have fun, guys. Really, I mean, I am serious. I would write my congressperson after a while. I'd say, I'm just curious, how much did this cost when this is all done? How much did this cost? Aren't you concerned that the FBI is wasting U.S. taxpayer money going after dissenting voices? I thought in America, that's what a citizen's supposed to do. Speak up, be heard, free speech. You know, and then the bigger question is, did we take orders from Ukraine? Because nobody in Congress wants to touch this. The fact that U.S. taxpayer dollars go to create entities in the Ukrainian government, which are organized under the supervision of the United States government for the sole purpose of attacking the free speech rights of American citizens, criminalizing it and putting Americans on a death list. It's not a hypothetical death list. I mean, I don't want to overhype this thing, but according to some information, they don't just have me on the list. They've been actively targeting me. Oh, yeah, FBI, by the way, thanks for doxing me, too. You know, putting all my information out there for the world to see where I live, what my house looks like, what the external security features of my house are, what the license plate number of my cars are. Gosh, that's really information you want the Ukrainian hit squads to have, don't you, you stupid idiots? And it's not theoretical. I was swatted that night. You know what swatting is? Swatting is when somebody makes a phone call that implies that something in this house going on that implies an immediate threat to life. So a SWAT team shows up. Oftentimes, the SWAT team shows up and unannounced, and they barge in, and people are surprised who they are, and they ended up getting shot and killed. Or dogs. I have four dogs. I love my dogs to death. They bark. SWAT team comes in. Dog comes charging up. Because what the hell is a dog supposed to do when somebody comes in the house unannounced? And they shoot my dog. You want to shoot my dogs? Fortunately, the Bethlehem Police Department, I live in the town of Bethlehem, New York. Everybody knows it. they know my address. They know my street. The Bethlehem Police Department, first of all, they know me. I was a firefighter for more than 10 years. Worked very close with the Bethlehem Police Department. And I have, you know, an ongoing relationship with the police department because of my criminal conviction and the need to register as a sex offender. So, you know, we get along well. We have a good relationship, no problems. And they know who I am. They know my address. And they showed up and they were very cool about it. Thank goodness. And they understand what was going on, that I had been swatted. So they're like, we got this under control. Don't worry about this. This is not going to become a problem. Moreover, if you see anybody, give us a call. We'll be there. So, you know, thank goodness I live in a neighborhood where we have a police department like this. But, you know, if I lived in a different neighborhood, that could have had a tragic outcome. I mean, who knows? That's the whole purpose of SWAT is to harass me. So, you know, there are unintended or intended consequences of this. It depends on how conspiratorial you want to get. But excuse my language. In short, this has been a big pain in the ass. You know, it's cost me thousands of dollars. It's cost me thousands of dollars of work. It's cost me thousands of dollars to replace the electronics that they took and aren't returning. I mean, they will return them eventually. But if you think I'm actually going to be using a computer that's been in the possession of the FBI, you know, smoke another joint, baby. You know, it is what it is. I'm not saying they did anything, but you'd be a damn fool. Not that I have anything to hide, but really? Who would buy a computer that says you're being monitored by the FBI? No, not in America, but apparently in America they can. But that's where it's at right now. I mean, I'm awaiting. I've been charged with nothing. And honestly, I don't think I will be charged with anything because there's nothing to charge me with. This search warrant was a fishing expedition. They thought that maybe they'd find evidence on the computer and the phone. I'm here to tell you that no such evidence exists. And they're going to find that out for themselves. And like I said, I hope when it shows up on the judge's desk that the judge starts asking questions. Like, who the hell authorized this? You gave me an affidavit that set up probable cause. You said that by going into his home and grabbing this computer, you're going to find this, but you didn't find that. So why did we invade this person's home? He's an American citizen. Why did we invade his home? And hopefully those questions are asked and answers are demanded. We'll see.
The other thing, Scott, many people are worried about you because they want you to announce a fundraising website in order to help you if something, we are not just putting yourself in a safe position. Are you planning to do that?
To do what?
To announce a fundraising website that people can help you on that.
Well, let me put it this way. This isn't my first rodeo. And I know that if the U.S. government decides to take it down the path of litigation, that can get to be very expensive. I've already filed for bankruptcy once. I mean, the legal system broke me financially, destroyed me financially, only because of the courage and perseverance of my wife, who got four jobs. Did we save our home, and were my children able to complete college? But I don't want to go through that again, and I don't want to put them through that again. Again, I'm hoping that reason prevails, and if the FBI is watching, hey, guys, in the future, knock on my damn door, take me out for coffee. I'll pay. Don't worry. You don't have to worry about your budget. And just ask me questions. Literally, if you have a concern, ask me a question. I will answer the question. I promise. I mean, that's just the way it works. I'm not anti-American. And if the FBI says they have a concern about something I'm doing, I'd like to know what that concern is. And I'd like to make that concern go away. Now, at the end of the day, if that concern has no basis in the rule of law and is all about, you know, shutting me up for political reasons, then we have a problem. But if it's a concern, look, they are responsible for enforcing the laws of the land. FARA regulations are the law of the land. You're not allowed to operate as a foreign agent. And if you choose to do so, then you have to register and be held accountable to the procedures there. I'm not a foreign agent. If they think I am, why don't they? They're supposed to issue a letter of inquiry. That's what the FARA investigation unit's supposed to do, is issue a letter of inquiry and saying, hey, we have concerns about this. But apparently something about my activity, I think it's the fact that I traveled to Russia for a long period of time and they have no idea what happened in Russia. And they're very concerned about uncontrolled, you know, access or whatever. I don't know. Then they felt compelled to do it this route. They should have issued the letter of inquiry. I would have responded and this could have gone away without all of the drama, but they didn't. But, you know, I'm not here. I'm not hiding anything. There's no covert relationship. There's no criminal activity. There's no hidden objective. I write about everything. I say everything. It's all in the public. So hopefully they won't go that route. But if they do, it could get very expensive. And I am talking to people right now, making a decision whether or not I need to retain legal counsel. I have to see what the next step is. What is the FBI going to do? I've given them all the information willingly and unwillingly that they need, supposedly, to reach a conclusion. So let's see what conclusion they reach and let's see what actions they take. But if it gets to the point where this has to be, you know, litigated further, then yeah, there will be a need to set up a legal assistance fund. And when that happens, if that decision has to be made sooner rather than later, meaning that you don't want to have the trouble and then go looking for money. You want the money in a war chest. And if trouble comes, you need to be prepared for it. So I'm talking to people about it, the best way to go forward with it, et cetera, et cetera. But it's definitely on my mind.
Yeah, I can definitely say that we are with you in this process, Scott. I personally am with you.
And well, thank you.
You can count on everything that I can do for you.
Just send me commissary when I'm in prison, okay?
buy
those tennis shoes. It'll put me out on the basketball court and get the extra ramen noodles for supplemental food on Thursday nights.
Yeah. Just change the shifting the gear to the conflict, Scott, in the Middle East right now. Mahmoud Abbas is in Russia right now talking to Putin. It seems that Vladimir Putin, when it comes to the conflict between Iran and Israel, they have been trying to make some sort of sanity in the whole situation there. And right now, Mahmoud Abbas is in Russia. What they're trying to do in order to deal with the conflict in the Middle East, in the eyes of Russians, I'm talking about.
Well, I don't know what the Russian plan is. Remember, I'm not an agent of the Russian government. So they haven't called me, and I'm not under orders to say anything to spread Russian disinformation or information or whatever. Look, I mean, we know that Russia has an interest in stability. Russia's interests are not destabilized. Russia's hosting the BRICS conference in October. This is a big deal. It's the middle of August. The last thing Russia needs is a broad Middle Eastern war that destabilizes not only the Middle East, but the world. That would have a devastating impact on the BRICS conference. Iran, you know, is a new member of BRICS. And, you know, Iran is looking for a new relationship with the world defined by its relationship with BRICS. And, you know, getting involved in a existential war against Israel is not in the national security interests of Iran, but Iran can't leave unanswered the assassination of the senior Hamas leader in Tehran by Israel. You know, I think Russia succeeded in buying time. One of the important things that Russia did was immediately fly in military equipment, primarily, I think, S-400 surface-to-air missiles, anti-ballistic missiles. They are now operational inside Iran. And this changes a lot from the Israeli perspective, because now Israel has to deal with a very advanced level of defense capacity that could be manned by Russia, could have connectivity with Russian satellites and things of that nature. So it changes a lot when it comes to, you know, any potential Israeli counterstrike. And so what Russia is doing is compelling Israel to, you know, rethink its plan, because Iran will have to retaliate. There's no doubt about this. There will have to be an Iranian retaliation. And it's going to have to be more serious than the retaliation that took place in April. In April was a demonstration of capability, now or of potential. And now I think whatever Iran does is going to have to demonstrate that that potential is reality, or else Iran loses any notion of deterrence, that Israel will have a green light to do anything it wants to do. So I think the Russians are talking about not just, you know, the Iranian retaliation, but then what happens next, because you can't say that you believe in bringing stability to the Middle East and all you do is limit Iranian retaliation, because after you limit that, and the situation goes away, how do you resolve the underlying crisis that created this? It was a Hamas leader that was assassinated in Tehran. That Hamas leader was a lead negotiator for bringing an end to the conflict in Gaza. And it is the conflict in Gaza that has mobilized the axis of resistance led by Iran against Israel. And so by inviting Abbas in, I think, you know, people are like, oh, does that mean that Russia is abandoning Hamas, you know, because China just had this big conference where they brought 14 different Palestinian factions together into a singularity, including Hamas and Fatah. But Abbas is the president of the Palestinian Authority. And right now he continues to be the face of legitimacy of the Palestinian state, or what passes for a Palestinian state. He has no credibility amongst the Palestinian people, and pretty much zero credibility around the world. He's recognized as an old, feeble, corrupt person. So why is Putin meeting with him? I think, you know, this might be the equivalent of Nancy Pelosi's conversation with Joe Biden, which is, it's time for you to go. You need to step aside. You need to relinquish power. If you want to live here in Moscow, maybe we'll give you a nice dacha out there. But it's time for you to get out of the way. Your day is done. You are more of a problem than you are a solution. The Palestinian people view you as a shill for Israel because you are a shill for Israel. I think that might be the conversation that's taking place in much more diplomatic terms by the Russians, who initiated, by the way, they're the ones, you know, the Chinese may have closed the deal, but it was the Russians who originally talked to Hamas and Fatah about coming together and creating this generic governmentation, a governmental representation for the Palestinian people. It's absolutely essential because Israel says we will never deal with Hamas. So sort of taking the page out of the American book, you know, back when the YPG in Syria, the Kurdish independent group, it's really a front for the PKK, which is a Turkish Kurdish independence group that Turkey and much of the world says is a terrorist organization, including the United States. And yet we're dealing with the YPG, which is an adjunct to the PKK, and the United States is like, well, we can't deal with terrorists. How do we handle this? Why don't you guys just call yourself something different? We'll call you the Syrian Democratic Forces. Problem solved. You're still the same terroristic son of a bitch we were dealing with last week. We just changed your name. And, you know, that's sort of the approach Russia's taking, which is let's take Hamas, blend them up with Fatah, and we got something different that's not called Hamas. And now the Israelis will have to deal with this. That's the idea. But they can't as long as Israel keeps interfacing with Abbas. As long as Israel says this is the legitimate face of the Palestinian people. So I think Abbas is the problem. Abbas has to go and make way for this new thing that China and Russia have come up with. That's just my assessment. Again, when I talked to my Russian controller this morning, he didn't have the up-to-date information. So I'm making a lot of this up. Oh, by the way, FBI, that's what's known as a joke. Get a sense of humor.
And the other thing, Scott, would be the question is why is this Iranian response to Israel taking too much time, in your opinion? What they're doing in Iran?
Let's back up just a second here. One, Israel made it clear that if Iran attacks precipitously in a manner that brings about Israeli civilian casualties, that Israel will have to respond, and they will respond by attacking Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Some of that nuclear infrastructure is buried underground, and the conventional bunker-busting bombs that the United States has provided to Israel can't penetrate it, which means that if Israel were to follow through with its threat to attack the nuclear infrastructure, and that threat was to have any meaning that you have to destroy that which you attack, Israel will have to use a nuclear bunker-busting weapon. That means that Israel would use nuclear weapons against Iran. And that's really an outcome nobody wants, because that just uncorks the nuclear genie, and it will never be recorked until Israel itself is destroyed by nuclear weapons, one way or another. And so Russia basically said, okay, we have to do a couple things. We have to buy time. So Russia bought time by immediately opening up the floodgates and giving, I don't know if that's the FBI deciding that I needed to go out of focus or what. Let me see if I can get back in focus.
Yeah, it's good.
There we go. All right. Thanks to the FBI technician who corrected that. Appreciate it. So the Russians bought time. They do that by providing capability. And the capability is designed to make Iran's nuclear infrastructure and other critical infrastructure a much more difficult target. Remember, hitting Iran is not going to be easy. Israel will have to, you know, fly long distances. They will have to refuel. And then they will have to penetrate layered air defense to get to the target they want to bomb and then get out of there. Israel had a certain attack profile already determined based upon Iran's existing air defense capabilities. And they had rehearsed that because this is something that just doesn't happen on the seat of the pants. It's a very carefully rehearsed strike package that Israel's run through the Negev desert, and they have all their plans in and they know how to do this. And Russia just made all the Israeli plans go away because now Israel has to deal with the S-400, which is a completely different ballgame. And Russia brought in other intelligence collecting capabilities, electronic warfare capabilities. Basically, they just made this problem of bombing Iran orders of magnitude more difficult. And so that's changed the Israeli response, which means now that Israel will have to increase its threshold of pain, because Israel isn't going to just go out there and blow things up if they can lose a whole bunch of pilots and a whole bunch of airplanes. They do risk management. And so by increasing the pain threshold, meaning that now Israel, in order to carry out that strike, they're going to have to lose a lot of equipment. That means that Israel now will be willing to absorb some pain as long as the pain delivered by Iran isn't as great. And so now Russia turns to the Iranians and says, if you need to attack, it needs to be a very focused attack on a very specific target, and no civilian casualties. And so Iran right now is revising its target planning, I believe, and has come up with a series of targets that it believes it can destroy, but it also believes that it won't result in civilian casualties. So the goal is to hit Israel and then absorb whatever Israel is willing to deliver, but it won't be strategic because of the Russian defenses, and then bring this thing to an end. Once again, to bring it an end. Nobody wants a wider war, and nobody wants a wider war more than Russia, because it will be devastating to the year of BRICS. This is the year of BRICS. BRICS is supposed to be the big thing. And right now, the Russian dream of BRICS dominance is being threatened by Ukrainian invasion in Kursk and this chance of a greater, wider, broader war in the Middle East between Iran and Israel.
There are rumors behind the scene that they're saying that the United States and Iran are talking, negotiating behind the scene in order to bring some sort of settlement, political settlement to the conflict. Do you think, is there any reality in this type of rumors?
The United States has a history of back-channel diplomacy with Iran. We saw that with the Iran nuclear deal. The JCPOA began with a series of secret meetings between people, including Jake Sullivan, by the way. Jake Sullivan was one of the original secret meters, back-channelists, working with Iran. And, this has been, I mean, go back all the way to Oliver North delivering a cake and a Bible, I guess, to the Iranian leadership, or Quran. I don't know what he delivered, but delivering stuff. We've been doing it for a while. And there's no doubt in my mind that we still have these back channels. I'm pretty sure that we talk with the Iranians to deconflict, to avoid allowing disagreements, sometimes even violent disagreements, from exploding into general war. It's in neither nation's interest. So there's no doubt in my mind that if such a back channel exists, it's being used today. And if it didn't exist, that the United States and Iran would be receptive to create it, because Iran doesn't need a war with Israel. But Iran's in an extraordinarily difficult position now because of what Israel did. And the United States recognizes that. The United States now is between a rock and a hard place, because they can't be seen as abandoning Israel. But on the other hand, they do not want to be part of a process of facilitating a broader conflict, which would, if it takes place, inevitably bring the United States, into direct confrontation with Iran. So, yeah, in the interest of peace, I would hope that the United States is engaged in serious back-channel diplomacy with Israel to try and mitigate this crisis.
If it goes that direction, it has to be something substantial in the hands of the United States to offer to Iran in order to have a negotiating table. But do you think the Biden administration does? Do they have any sort of leverage on the Netanyahu administration to offer something so important? For example, the situation in Gaza is so dire, it's unbelievable. Just put an end to that operation and making the life of Gazans better than it is right now. How do you see these talks? Is the Biden administration capable of doing this?
I don't think the Biden administration, first of all, I don't think the any back channel discussion between Iran and the United States is seeking to bring about an end to the overall. That's just not going to happen. It's not feasible. The United States isn't capable of pulling that off. I think whatever back channel discussions are taking place are designed to prevent a broader war. That's it. And then once that happens, then I think the United States is recognizing the importance of the role of Russia and China in this. The United States will use whatever leverage it can against Israel to try and bring the two points together. This is a problem that will not be solved by the United States and the United States alone. So the idea that the United States is carrying out some sort of magic peace formula behind the scenes with Russia, I think is not founded in reality. I think whatever conversations they're having are purely limited to how do we keep this war from spinning out of control? How do we convince the Iranians that while we will defend Israel and while we'll be seen posturing as being there for Israel, that, we're not going to be part of any Israeli retaliation. And notice the United States hasn't screamed bloody murder about the deployment of Russian air defense systems into Iran. I mean, normally, we're going to sanction everybody. Everybody's going to die of sanctions. Nothing. Why? Because the United States understands that that is actually bringing stability to the region. Because Israel's out of control. Even the United States recognizes that Benjamin Netanyahu is totally out of control. The dual assassinations that took place in Beirut and Tehran, were just a direct slap in the face of the United States, where the United States told them that we're not going to support a broader war with Iran or a broader war with Lebanon. So Netanyahu went back and said, kill senior people. Now what are you going to do about it? Because America, having wrapped Benjamin Netanyahu in the flag, is now trapped. Having anointed him to be the leader of Israel, they're now trapped because, he didn't invade. The Pentagon said, don't invade. All he did is assassinate a bad guy. And the Americans were, our position is both those guys who were killed are bad guys. So how do we oppose it? Netanyahu's a smart guy, able to play the Americans like a finely tuned clock. But now he has to live with the consequences. And I think he's hopeful. I don't think Netanyahu wants a broader war either. Because if there is a broader war, it's going to be devastating for Israel. Extraordinarily. And Hezbollah sent a message the other night, firing dozens of rockets into an Israeli military facility in northern Israel, and the Iron Dome didn't respond. Why? Well, nobody's talking. Did they hack it? Probably. But Hezbollah is saying, we can shut you down like that. And then the places you think are defended aren't. And if we can do it, so can Big Brother, because it was probably Big Brother that did it. If you don't think there's Iranian electronic warfare specialists embedded with Hezbollah, then you don't have any understanding about the Hezbollah-Iranian relationship.
They know, Scott, from the latest attack of Iranian, latest and the first attack of Iranian on Israel, and the United States together with the United Kingdom, they know that they're limited in defending Israel at the end of the day. I think that's the reason that they have to talk with Netanyahu and his administration. We are limited, that you have to find another way of dealing with this problem right now. Because a greater war is not in the benefit of anybody, any party in this game.
No, a greater war. I mean, we're limited politically, domestically, politically. We're incapable of putting forward meaningful policy that can pressure Israel because of the extent of Israeli control over the American Congress, of the American presidency, of the American establishment. Pro-Israeli, resources are embedded everywhere. They're embedded at CNN. They're embedded at ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, Fox. It's all pro-Israeli. New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, all pro-Israeli. The President of the United States, owned by AIPAC. The Vice President of the United States, owned by AIPAC, the Secretary of Defense, owned by AIPAC and the defense industry, Speaker of the House, everything's owned by AIPAC. AIPAC sent a powerful message this last congressional election cycle, $100 million spent, every single person they supported in the primary won. including one that they spent $24 million on. $24 million. We know this because they brag about it. They brag openly about it. Here I am being prosecuted as a foreign agent of Russia for nothing. And Israel is buying American politicians and they just get away with it. I mean, the hypocrisy is just stunning. But, you know, no one's going to do anything because how do you prosecute yourself?
How do you see the situation of the Netanyahu administration? Right now, it seems that Netanyahu and his party, the Likud party, are just against the Ministry of Defense. If you were to mention the main reasons of this difference between these two important players of the Netanyahu administration, what would you draw from us?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Benjamin Netanyahu only cares about Benjamin Netanyahu. He cares about his political survival. And in that context, we also have to point out that many people, including myself, have written him off before. I thought it was the end of Benjamin Netanyahu when he lost the last election. I thought for certain he'd be arrested, charged, put on trial, spend the rest of his life in jail. But he's a political survivor, and he knows Israel better than just about anybody. And he was able to orchestrate successive collapses of opposition government until he was able to assemble a coalition and win election. And then he did an attack on the courts and ended the ability for him to be prosecuted, at least while he's in office. Let's see what happens when he leaves. But he knows that once he leaves office, there will be an accounting. He will be held accountable not only for his past crimes, but for the perception that he was criminally negligent based upon what happened on October 7th. And now Israel is being held criminally negligent by the world for the actions ordered by Netanyahu, the empowerment of the far right, which brings in, Talmudic thinking when it comes to, Israel's relationship with the Palestinians. These are human animals. Rape is permitted, encouraged, on and on and on. So Netanyahu knows that he can't fail. So if you know you can't fail, and you know what the consequences of failure are, that means that you've just expanded the options available to you, because some options, which a rational thinker, a rational player would say, the consequences of failure on that are too grave. We're going to ratchet it down a little bit and take the middle ground. For him, he has no choice. He can't play safe. He has to go hard the whole time. And that's what he's doing right now. And provoking these crises. That's what his motivation is, to stay in power.
One of the important elements right now is what's going on in Iraq, because Iraq goes to Syria, then Syria to Israel. Do you think that the Biden administration is thinking of withdrawing the troops from Iraq?
I'll answer that, but while you were doing that, I remembered, I was like, he asked me another question in that first one, and it was about the military and the relationship between Netanyahu and the military. So let me answer that in case your audience says, Scott deliberately avoided that because the Israelis are putting pressure on him. He's afraid of Israel. Psst, I'm not afraid of anybody but my wife, okay? She does scare me. But 33 years of marital bliss because I toe the line, because I'm afraid of her when she gets mad. She rarely does. But other than that, there's nothing out there that I'm afraid of. I'm worried about things. I don't want things to happen. But if you honestly think that you could scare me, whether you're Israel, Russia, the United States, you can't, because what am I supposed to fear? The consequences of being righteous? Too bad, baby. I was in the Marine Corps. It doesn't work. If I was doing something wrong, if I was on the run, on the lam, maybe fear factors in. But no. So for all the conspiracy theorists out there thinking that the Israelis have me on the run, no, they don't. They simply don't. Neither do the Ukrainians. The Russians don't own me. The American government doesn't control me. So let's knock that off. The Israeli Defense Force, I used to work very closely with them back in the 1990s. And I respect their professionalism. This is before I understood about, and before they had been perverted by the far right, which insinuated itself everywhere in Israel, including the military, so that, you know, people who once may have had a capacity for human compassion no longer do. Religious fanatics have taken over, so that Dahiwa principles, mowing the grass, become the norm. You know, that wasn't the IDF that I dealt with. But the IDF, you know, is professional. They take the job of defending Israel very seriously, regardless how it's defined, whether it's a Yitzhak Rabin definition of Israel or a Benjamin Netanyahu definition of Israel. The IDF's job is to defend it. The IDF understands that the situation they confront today was never planned for, and there's no contingency for it. They've never planned for a war lasting this long that depletes human and material resources at this rate. They're exhausted, both physically, morally, and materially. They've run out of spare parts for their tanks, so every tank that's damaged is equivalent of a destroyed tank. They're running out of ammunition, aircraft. I'd love to see the Israeli figures on aircraft maintenance. You know, these planes don't fly themselves. And for every hour you're in the air, there's a X number of hours on the ground. These planes have to be shooting through, you know, maintenance windows that can't be maintained because of operational tempo. So there's just a whole bunch of things happening that have the Israeli military saying, we can't continue to do this. Not only can't we continue to do this, but we can't expand this operation into both a full-scale reinvasion of Gaza or a full-scale war with Hezbollah. So there's a disconnect. The Israeli Defense Force leadership is not supportive of the forever war that Benjamin Netanyahu needs to continue to stay in power. They recognize an absolute necessity to bring this war to an end. And so you have a difference of opinions there. And this gets interesting. I just, again, want to remind your listeners that before the October 7th attack took place, Israel was in a state of crisis with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets protesting against Benjamin Netanyahu. And the president of Israel at that time said that Israel was on the cusp of real civil war, not civil conflict, not civil disobedience, civil war between two armed elements who were vociferously opposed to one another, who would fight it out as a war. That situation hasn't gone away. There's still deep divisions within Israel. October 7th, they tried to paper over those divisions, but they're being exposed. And many of those divisions relate to Benjamin Netanyahu as a human being, as a failed political leader. And the Israeli army knows this. They understand how sensitive. Heck, we saw it play out when those nine Israeli soldiers who raped Palestinian prisoners were in prison. And we saw a near civil war break out as elements of the Israeli society and elements within the Israeli military demanded, not only demanded their release, but in one ridiculous moment, were pounding on the doors demanding to be allowed in so they could rape Palestinian prisoners, because apparently rabbis say that that's okay under Talmudic law. So, it's a very, very dangerous situation. The Israeli military is aware of that. And I think that's why you're seeing a split between the Israeli military and Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think the assassinations that took place, again, those assassinations would have been carried out by the Mossad, represent some sort of compromise solution within the war cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu.
And with the case of American troops in Iraq.
Do I think they're leaving? Yes. Do I think they'll be out in 2025? Most likely. This is an untenable situation. First of all, we don't have a solution to the ISIS problem. To solve ISIS, ISIS is an ideology. And to solve the problem of ISIS ideology, you have to eliminate the attraction of that ideology to certain socio-political religious groups. As long as the United States remains in Iraq and in Syria, we are empowering the elements of Iraq and Syrian society that are sympathetic to the ISIS cause. This is basically tribal in nature, regional in nature, but it it's definitely contributed to by the presence of American troops. Anybody who's fought terrorists and knows about low intensity conflict understands this. If you go out and kill five bad guys, you gave birth to 500. And that's what's happening right now. We have special forces operating in Iraq and Syria that are going out and popping off a couple bad guys here and a bad guys there, but it's not changing the outcome. You can't defeat an ideology. And it's becoming more and more difficult to logistically sustain this military footprint in Iraq and by extension Syria, because Syria doesn't exist without Iraq. Understand that if we withdraw from Iraq, we're leaving Syria, because the logistics hub, which goes from Kuwait all the way up to Erbil and then crosses over into Syria, if you eliminate that, you take out the Erbil base. Now, one of the interesting things is when we speak of an American withdrawal, are we talking about from all of Iraq, or are we only talking about from the part of Iraq that the Kurdish Regional Authority doesn't command? But you know, the Kurdish Regional Authority, was their back was broken a while ago when they tried to make a move on the Kirkuk oil fields, and the Iraqi army came in and shut that down. So the idea of a genuinely independent Iraqi Kurdistan is, I don't think that's no longer viable. So I think that when they talk about the removal of American troops from Iraq, they're just talking about all of Iraq. And if you remove Erbil, then you're out of Syria. So I think you're going to see Syria withdrawn, Al-Tanf withdrawn, and then we're going to begin to withdraw from Erbil, and then we're going to make the retrograde down to Kuwait, and then we go home. That's what I think is going to happen, because this has become untenable for the United States. Too many political questions are starting to be asked about why we're there. What's the reason? And I think, you know, while I don't think that we have officials who are open-minded enough to understand the cause and effect relationship between the presence of Americans and the sustainment of ISIS ideology, and then act on that responsibly. I think the way we get ISIS shut down is to get Americans out, and then have the governments of Syria and Iraq do whatever socioeconomic, political reforms are necessary to alleviate the concerns of the tribal groups and the ethnic groups that were attracted to ISIS. And then ISIS goes away, because it can't exist if you don't have, you know, a festering cesspool of societal unrest. And that's what grows ISIS. If everything's hunky-dory, ISIS has no place to take root.
In your opinion, if things getting out of the hand and something big happens between Iran and Israel, even the United States, what are we going to expect from Turkey and Pakistan, in your opinion, in that case?
You know, both Turkey and Pakistan, but especially Turkey, are prisoners to a domestic political reality that ends up impacting foreign policy decisions more than we in the collective West truly understand. Erdogan is a political survivor. He's been in power a long time, and he does it by playing political games, you know, building, rebuilding coalitions. And he just survived, his party survived a local election where he lost a lot of support because of the Israeli problem. And so he is embracing policy directions, articulating policy, saying things that seeks to repair the damage that was made between, you know, his himself and his party and you know, the Islamist element of Turkey. I think people should remember that even though the history of modern Turkey, the Turkish Republic, is one of a secular republic, that it's always been a deeply Islamist state, and the Turkish people are deeply religious. When I was in Turkey in the 1970s, my father was stationed there. I think there was a guy named Erbokan, or I could be getting that name wrong, but he was an Islamist leader, and there was just problems. He and Ecevit were, and Demirel were wrestling, but the Islamists, you know, the military had to move in, remove them from power, and then they came back. Erdogan is actually part of the Erbokan Islamist movement, but Erbakan step aside. But Erdogan is the, you know, the successor. He's an Islamist. And now he's in power. Turkey is an Islamist state. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a Muslim-dominated country. Of course it is. But that's a reality that you can't, you know, engage in secular policies that are seen as being harmful to fellow practitioners of the Islamic faith and not pay a political price. So, you know, I don't, but Turkey's also realistic. It, again, it has goals. Erdogan wants to attend BRICS. He's elected the big pivot away from the EU. You know, he requires stability in the region. Invading Israel is the least destabilizing thing one can possibly imagine. So I think there's a lot of politicized rhetoric. I don't see it, Turkey doing anything precipitous. The same thing with Pakistan. The one thing that I'm, where I would put a lot of focus on, though, is Pakistan has the Muslim bomb. And Israel needs just to keep that in mind. I don't know what deals have been cut between Pakistan and Iran. I do know that any use of nuclear weapons by Israel against Iran will probably not see the consequences finished until nuclear weapons, a Muslim bomb, have been used against Israel. Now, who fires that Muslim bomb? Iran, Pakistan? Doesn't really matter, because Israel is such a small state. The use of nuclear weapons on Israeli soil will terminate the Israeli state. And that's the consequences that Israel needs to understand. That's what bothers me about Pakistan, is it's the fact that it has a Muslim bomb, and they understand the dire consequences of allowing Israel to strike a Muslim state with nuclear weapons without response. Israel has to be put on notice. You can't do it. You can't use nuclear weapons against the against an Islamic state. So that, I think that's the role that Pakistan plays. And, you know, there's whispers about this. These are conversations that simply cannot be had in public, you know, by Pakistani government officials. But you also, it doesn't do anybody good to have a theory buried in your head that you don't articulate, so therefore nobody knows about it, especially if the theory buried in your head is supposed to deter people from certain actions. So I'm confident that Pakistan's using whatever mechanisms are available to it to make sure that the potential of extraordinarily dire consequences accrued to Israel if they use nuclear weapons against Iran exists.
When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, Lindsey Graham is so excited talking about this operation on the Kursk region. He says that it's brilliant, it's unbelievable. And Zelensky is talking about this is Putin's end. And in your opinion, what's important about this operation and why they're talking a lot about this operation? And what's the benefit coming out of this operation for Ukraine or even for people like Lindsey Graham?
Well, first of all, it appears that Ukraine has been preparing for this together with their NATO masters for a long time. This operation was months, if not years, in the planning. This operation uses, the Russians, you know, are capturing equipment and evaluating equipment. They're looking at things. This is a NATO army. What I mean by that is they're using NATO weapons, but more importantly, they're using NATO tactics. And I'm not talking about just, you know, small unit tactics, et cetera. We're talking about the next phase of warfare, where each piece of military equipment, each soldier is linked collectively into some sort of singularity of information resources that can be communicated to a remote command post that has total situational awareness and is able to direct things. They have intelligence beamed in on this and real time, and they're able to predict Russian movements and anticipate Russian movements. They're deploying new generations of drones, including some high-speed drones that are being used to shoot down Russian helicopters. These are the best troops in Ukraine, the best equipped, the best trained. They've been trained by NATO, by the British, by the Americans, and they're in it to win. I mean, this is the thing people have to understand is that this isn't a limited incursion. This is an effort to defeat Russia on the battlefield, to capture a significant part of Russia, to disrupt significant parts of the Russian economy. I mean, two of the objectives are this oil transfer station and the Kursk nuclear power plant. These are objectives to be disrupted, damaged, destroyed by the Ukrainian invader. But they're supposed to hold on to this territory, not give it back. This is a Western army that went in. This is a NATO army that went in, fighting the next generation war that NATO, you know, all NATO troops are being trained upon. The irony is that apparently only the Ukrainians know how to do it now. This is a totally different approach than it was taken in the summer of 2023 when the Ukrainians launched their big counteroffensive that failed dramatically against Russian defenses. The Ukrainians and NATO recognized by late summer, early fall of 2023 that they can't do that again. And they've been husbanding resources, resources that should have gone to the front lines to fill the gaps. But Ukraine has sacrificed so many troops in the Donbass fighting a futile fight, buying time so that this new NATO army could be built. And look, they've got the M1 tanks. They've got the Leopards. They've got the Bradleys. They've got the Strikers. They've got the Martyrs. They've got the Caesar artillery, M777. They got the HIMARS. It's all there, all integrated using Starlink and other communications capabilities that are managed by Americans and NATO people. They have embedded the Ukrainian force with facilitators, whether you want to call them mercenaries or sheep dipped, doesn't matter. They're not Ukrainian. And many of the combat forces are literally Polish army forces that have been redesignated as Ukrainian forces. There's some French combat units. We're talking about, you know, company size units of Frenchmen that fight as a unit under the flag of Ukraine, but wearing the French arm patch. There's lots of Americans there. You know, so this is it. This is the strategic reserve of Ukraine. And the idea that they would throw it away in a futile effort is absurd. The Ukrainians believe they can win. The Ukrainians believe they are winning. Now, I've spoken to Russians and I listened to Opti Aladonov. And the Russians, of course, are of a different opinion. And I think the majority of the West shares the Russian opinion, meaning, wow, Ukraine, good job. Nice little temporary victory. But what happens when Russia starts to grind you down? But, you know, the goal here was to inflict political damage on Russia, to embarrass Vladimir Putin to an extent that succeeded, but you have to understand that Putin is untouchable in this regard. He just won an election. He has, you know, 80% support of the population. So the idea you're doing political damage to Putin is absurd. You're actually just strengthening him because the Russian people are programmed to rally around their leader, and now all of Russia is rallying around this cause. One of the goals was to divert Russian military resources away from the Donbass, from Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporizhia fronts. Nope, those forces have remained intact, and they continue to advance. People have forgotten that Russia's taking 5, 6, 10 kilometers worth of territory a day in this inexorable advance across the Ukrainian plains of Donbass. You know, and then the other one was to do not just political harm to Putin, but to break the will of the Russian people. And they failed on that. Can the Ukrainians dig in and hold off the Russian attacks and then say, aha, we got a piece of territory in Kursk that we'll trade you for Kherson? The West loves this idea, but it's stupid because Kherson is Russia. It's been accepted into Russia constitutionally. It's part of Russia, and Russia is not in the business of giving Russia away. So, you know, it's one of those non-starters. You just have to scratch your head and say, why did you even think that was a possibility? But that's where they're at. You know, and the last thing is to create they're trying to convince the West that the investments that the West has made has been worth it. Now, Ukraine is losing everything. So for this gambit to work, the West will now have to double down on providing new Abrams, new Leopards, new Bradleys, new Martyrs, because they're being burned through right now in significant numbers. Ukraine needs more Western aid. That Western aid was slowing down. Ukraine's hopeful by carrying out, you know, what it is claiming is a successful military attack against Russia and Kursk, that the West will step up to the plate. I don't think the West is buying into it, to be honest. And I don't think the Ukrainian army is buying into it anymore either. They're in a very difficult situation. And it's one that, you know, good, effective military leadership is going to have to evaluate and determine what the next course of action is. But generally speaking, in order to survive, they're going to have to retreat. And I think that's what's next in store for Ukraine, is a big, massive retreat from Kursk.
The problem is, it seems that in the eyes of NATO, they're thinking that Russia wants to capture all of Ukraine. That's why Russia is losing. But in the eyes of Russians, that's not the case. And everybody around the world understands that Russia is not interested in the western part of Ukraine. They have already achieved what they wanted to achieve. But in terms of politically demilitarizing and denazifying, they don't need to go to the western part of Ukraine to demilitarize and denazify.
That was pre-Kursk. Let's just clear the record here. NATO invaded Russia using Ukraine as a proxy. Let me just say it one more time so you understand the gravity of what I'm saying. NATO invaded Russia, the heartland of Russia, Kursk. NATO invaded, has it sunk in yet what I just said? That's a game-changing event, Nima. Forget anything you thought about this before, it's over. It's done. Ukraine is dead. That's the only outcome now. Ukraine is dead. Now, the question is, does the West want to die alongside it? I spoke to a Russian official today, and he wouldn't get specific, but he basically said, this decision's already been made, and you'll know what I'm talking about when it happens, and it won't take too long for it to happen. See, Ukraine and the West have been laboring under this perception that Russia's at war. I don't know how many times Putin and the Russians had to say, guys, we're not even close to being at war. This is a special military operation. We're sort of like tying one leg, you know, back and one hand back and sort of hopping around. NATO invaded Russia. And so, I don't know who's calling me, but they'll have to wait. NATO invaded Russia. So this is going to bring about a terrible Russian response. It's the end of Zelensky's regime. It will not be allowed to exist. It's the end of Ukraine. Dmitry Medvedev hinted at what the consequences will be. Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Nikolaev, Kharkov, and now Sumy. See, Sumy wasn't on that map anymore. But now it is. This incursion into Kursk cost Ukraine Sumy. Russia's not going to give it back. It may have cost them Kiev. It may have cost them. And you say Russia doesn't want Western Ukraine. That doesn't mean Russia can't destroy Western Ukraine. And if you think there's going to be a city of Lvov left over when this is done, think again. Lvov is the heart of Banderist ideology. And Russia has now said it's over. Finished. Desvidaniya. That's just my perception. But I have to tell you that this official who is connected, he's in government, made it clear that Ukraine is going to learn what war is in the very near future. And he said it will send a shiver down the spine of everybody in the West. So congratulations, NATO, you idiots. You invaded Russia, and you didn't think there was going to be a price to be paid. And the other thing that the individual said is bases operating on NATO soil that are being used to support this are no longer off limits. So I think Russia is going to hit Ukraine and show the world what war is. And as he said, you guys think we haven't been developing weapons, that we don't have weapons. We are going to basically unleash some new weapons that will show the West that what will happen to you if you want to go to war with Russia, if you want war with Russia, what will happen to you, because it's about to happen to Ukraine. And then I think Russia is going to say, you have F-16s operating on Romanian soil. No, you don't. They no longer exist. Neither does the air base where they were at. You don't get to support your war against Russia in Ukraine using bases in Poland and Romania, because you invaded Kursk. You invaded Russia. NATO invaded Russia. I just want everybody to understand what happened, what is happening, and why it's going to be a game-changing event, at least according to this Russian politician. Now, could he be blowing smoke? He didn't seem to be the kind of guy that blew smoke, but we'll find out.
The other thing, Scott, in Germany, they're talking about, they're bragging that German tanks on the Russian soil. It's unbelievable when you look at Germany and the way they're hurting themselves because of the conflict in Ukraine, and they're not gaining anything but losing. How we can understand their behavior in your opinion?
People got mad at me when I said it before, but I'll say it again. Scratch a German, you get a Nazi. If you're a German and you're proud of the fact that German tanks are operating on Russian soil, not just in Ukraine, but on Russian soil, in Kursk, means you're an idiot and you're a Nazi at heart. Means you have the same DNA as your Nazi forefathers. And you believe in the same things. I think Dmitry Medvedev said it best, that if you're proud about having a new generation of German tanks on Russian soil, then we'll be more than happy to upgrade the Russian tanks that are mounted on the plinths outside of the German parliament in Berlin. Right now they have two T-34-85s, which were part of the Russian force that captured Berlin from the Nazis. What game does Germany want to play? Russia's fed up. I don't understand. At least General Cavoli understands that. He said, you know, when this ends, he said, we will be facing the largest military in the world, the most powerful military in the world, governed by a very angry government. NATO invaded Russia. NATO invaded Russia. There's no equivalency. You see, people are like, well, Russia invaded Ukraine, therefore Ukraine can be. No. Ukraine had an illegal Western coup that removed the constitutionally elected government, replaced it with ultra-nationalists who then declared war against Russians, ethnic Russians, Russian culture, Russian language, in the Donbass, slaughtering the Russians, and eventually compelling the leader of the Russian people to intervene to save the Russians. There's no equivalency here. These are bad people. These are banderas. These are Nazis. Well, the Germans know this because they're Nazis too. Scratch a German, get a Nazi. Germany, prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. Hold accountable those politicians, those military people who are gloating that there's German tanks killing Russians on Russian soil today. If you don't condemn this with every ounce of your being, then you're human scum. You're Nazis. Prove me wrong.
It's so amazing, Scott, when you look at the behavior of the Biden administration, considering all these difficulties that we are having in Ukraine, in Africa, in the Middle East, and they could have some sort of relationship to work with each other in order to bring these tensions down, or for the benefit of all the parties involved. But they have decided to double down on Ukraine, which doesn't make any sort of sense for me, for anybody. And why Ukraine is so important, why it's all done, you cannot do anything. But maybe you have to consider any sort of other type of solutions for the conflict in order to have, because the day after this conflict is over, it's much more important than what's going on right now, in my opinion, because the war, as you mentioned, is already done.
I think the problem is a lack of imagination on the part of the Biden administration and those who are in the American establishment advising the Biden administration on Russian policy. And understand, these are the same people that will advise a Trump administration. We have lost the generation that produced Jack Matlock, the last great American ambassador to the Soviet Union. Everybody that's come after him has been horrible, especially those in the 90s and in the 2000s who were sent to not help Russia, but to destroy Russia. You know, the Stroke Talbots, the Michael McFalls. These are the worst people in the world because they're not experts on Russia. They're experts on destroying Russia. They're experts on manipulating Russia. They're experts on trying to transform Russia into something that Russia isn't. And they are all steadfastly against Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader who came after Boris Yeltsin, who said, nah, Russia isn't defined by the 90s. Russia is defined by Russia. It'll be Russians that define Russia. Again, my daughter just graduated from Georgetown University, the School of Foreign Service, and or the Foreign Service Institute. And you know, she got her master's degree, and her classmates were all people who are going into the State Department or going into, you know, working with, you know, the various National Endowment for Democracy think tanks and things of that nature. They are indoctrinated, not educated. The whole process of higher education in America today that used to produce some of the best foreign area officers in the world, the Soviet FAOs, foreign area officers that were produced by the United States back in the 1970s and the 1980s, were the best in the world, genuine experts about the Soviet Union, about Russia, culture, linguistically. They understood it, they could give good advice. And the United States State Department was staffed with genuine Russian experts, not pro-Russian people, pro-American. But people who understood Russia, therefore, were able to come up with sound policy about Russia. They were all purged after the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were told that their skill set was no longer welcome. I remember I applied to the CIA in the early 1990s to be a Russian analyst. And I was encouraged to do so by the CIA, by old school people who knew me back in the days when I was a weapons inspector in the former Soviet Union. And I remember being interviewed by the head of the new Office for Russian and East European Affairs, OREO, I think they called it. And I had a long talk with them. I mean, my resume is clear, 2 classified commendations from the director of the CIA for my work in Russia. I thought it would have been a shoo-in. And in the end, he said, no, we can't take you because you're old thinking. We don't want old thinking. We don't want that Soviet taint. We need new thinkers. And so the CIA purged all of their real experts, and they brought in people. And at the same time, they changed their whole analytical or organizational methodology. When I was doing stuff with the CIA, I was never a CIA employee. I want to make that clear. But I used to have the special badge. I could go around the CIA. And I used to talk with CIA people about various issues pertaining to Russia. If I had an issue pertaining to photo interpretation, wanted to know something about X on the ground, the guy that I would talk to had been sitting in that chair for decades, looking at the same piece of ground for decades. He was a damn expert upon that. He could tell you if it was a red ant or a black ant that made that anthill. He was that good. I'm exaggerating. But the CIA decided that that wasn't cost effective, that they needed to basically diversify their workforce. And so instead of allowing people to sit in the same desk, do the same job and get promoted in place, instead they started to take people and move them from job to job. So you do a 6-month tour here, you do a 6-month tour there. And instead of being a master of your trade, you became a jack of all, which means you didn't know how to do anything. And I saw it when I was a weapons inspector in Iraq. I had to deal with this new generation of CIA analysts, and it's an embarrassment. When they come in and brief us on their interpretation of U-2 imagery over Iraq, they didn't know what the hell they were looking at. It became really apparent when myself and others who had just gotten back from Iraq inspecting the very site that the CIA is now briefing us on, when they didn't know anything. They're just making it up. Suspicious crane. Why is it suspicious? I asked. Well, it's there. Yeah, but do you know why it's there? No, that's why it's suspicious. Did you read my inspection report? No, we don't have access to that inspection report. Well, you know, that crane's there to repair the hole in the roof. Did you look at the suspicious hole in the roof? Well, yes. Well, we believe that that's a modification being made to the roof to bring in potential computer numerically controlled machine tools so that Iraq can expand its ballistic missile production capability. I said, no, the hole in the roof's there because it flooded there. Did you read the weather report? You see the flood? You see the rivulet down there where the waters come in and undermined the wall, and the wall came down, and then the beam came down because the support came down. So you got a hole in the roof. Now, the Iraqis have shored it up, but they haven't repaired that roof yet. So it's about flooding. It's not about ballistic missile production. You just made all that stuff up because you're an idiot. And that's the CIA today, staffed by idiots, people who don't know anything about anything. They aren't allowed to get smart on Russia because we don't want experts on Russia. Because if we had real experts on Russia, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing today. The most dangerous person in the world is somebody who actually goes to Russia, learns about Russia, and tries to bring that knowledge back. Me. Why do you think they raided my house? All right. I know more about Russia than any CIA analyst out there. And I challenge them right now to a debate. I have more relevant information than them. I'll tell you one reason why. Back in February of 2023, and again, February of this year, I attended what's called Defender of the Fatherland's Day celebration at the Russian embassy, sort of a celebration of the Russian military. I got to meet the defense attaché and his staff, all of his colonels, and we would talk. That's sort of what defense attachés do for a living, you know, they talk. And back in the day, if I were on active duty, talking to these guys, I would have gone back and I would have written reports about what we talked about, because that's the game that's being played. They're picking your brain, you're picking their brains. And you go back and you say, hey, well, you know, this person said this or this person said that, and we think it means this. And you write that report. Not a single American was in it from the defense establishment was present at this. These guys aren't talking to Americans. Americans aren't allowed to talk to them. I know more about the Russian military than any American analyst because I get to talk to them. I'm not bragging or anything, but Apti Aladonov, the man who's leading the, or one of the leaders of this, of the Russian response to Kursk, I've met. I count him as a friend. I've had many conversations with him. Can anybody else in the U.S. military, in the U.S. intelligence community say that? Have they sat down with Ramzan Kadyrov and talked to him? Have they talked to Adam Delikonov? Have they talked to Lord? They don't know anything about Chechnya or the role that Chechnya plays. I'm not saying that you have to sit there and support Chechnya and support all this. I'm sympathetic to them, but I'm not here to support anybody. I'm here to learn the reality. I know more about Chechnya than any CIA analyst because I spent more time in Chechnya than any CIA analyst. I know more about Russia and the interior of Russia. I know more about Novosibirsk industrial capacity or Kursk or Ekaterinburg, why I've been there. I've talked to the people, not as a spy, just as an American citizen. But I'm the most dangerous person to the United States government because I know the reality of Russia, and they don't want this reality transmitted to the American people. That's a threat. The CIA is weak. The State Department has no Russian experts, none. They have experts in manipulating Russia. But they don't have any Russian experts, people that can sit down and say, yes, let's converse. Jack Matlock was a Russian expert. Michael McFaul was not a Russian expert. That's the difference.
The other thing, Scott, would be the Shoigu is talking about sending military equipments to Serbia. And how do you find, we had large protests in Serbia against some companies. And right now they're talking, how do you see the relationship between Russia and Serbia, and where is that going? How do you find the way that it's going right now?
Serbia and Russia have, you know, historically have very close relations. They're brother Slavs. There are some difficulties with the current Serbian government, which has often yielded under pressure from the European Union and NATO to do things that can be interpreted as anti-Russian. But Russia understands this. If you listen to the statements made by the Russian Foreign Ministry, they say, we understand the pressures that Serbia is under. We understand the realities. Russia thinks strategically. And so they're not going to have a knee-jerk reaction that damages relations. They're just going to ride out the storm because Russia is confident that eventually the West will do something that brings Serbia inexorably into the Russian corner. And that's what's happening right now. The West is seeking to try and put a color revolution together in Serbia to overthrow the Serbian government. And Russia won't let that happen. And so that's what's going on. Russia's with Serbia and will stand with Serbia and will not allow Serbia to be brought into the Western orbit.
Is that the case in Georgia as well? Do we have any sort of information coming out of Georgia right now, or the case just is the case is gone? It's not working anymore.
The United States lost Georgia. We had Georgia. We owned Georgia. Georgians were with us. My daughter was a Peace Corps volunteer in Georgia, spent 2.5 years there. You know, you really have to screw up to lose Georgia. Georgia was so firmly inside the American camp, so firmly inside the European Union camp, that they passed a constitutional amendment that said that we have to become part of the European Union. That's done now, finished. I mean, the amendment's still there, but it's just not going to happen. Why? Because, again, we don't have Russian experts. We have people who are experts in manipulating and exploiting Russia. And what the Georgian people learned is that whatever Georgian experts we had aren't friends of Georgia. See, the United States is incapable of being a friend of anybody. We're only friends of ourselves. We use everybody. If we had just simply put on our thinking caps, asked ourselves, what are the highest priorities for the Georgians and how can we meet those priorities? The Georgians would have bent over backwards for us. You know, you don't have to have Georgia in NATO for Georgia to be in NATO. Anybody who understands Georgia knows what I'm talking about. We already had a Georgian military that was training with NATO, equipped with NATO, everything but NATO. You don't have to have Article 5 protections for Georgia. First of all, it's unrealistic as long as Abkhazia and South Ossetia continue to be disputed territories. Imagine if the United States actually articulated a plan, a realistic plan for getting Abkhazia and South Ossetia back. Imagine if we told the Georgians that in order to do that, you're going to have to improve relations with the Russians. You're going to have to. Now, that doesn't mean that you walk away from the United States. Imagine if we're the country that's facilitating this improvement of relations so that Russia feels comfortable with Georgia being reunited and also being in the Western orbit. See, if we cared about the Georgians, we wouldn't have to stick a thumb in the Russian eyes. We would teach the Georgians to peacefully coexist with the Russians. We would be like the Russians, thinking strategically long term. You see, once Georgia is reunified and then Georgia now is inclined to say, hey, we can peacefully coexist with Russia and have good economic relations. They need good economic relations, but we can be part of the West too. They can join the European Union. See, the European Union never really wanted them. That's the thing. NATO never wanted them. The European Union never wanted them. It was never going to happen. We were simply using Georgia as a tool to take down Russia. And the Georgians woke up to that reality. Fortunately for Georgia, the Georgian Dream government woke up to that reality in time to check it and save Georgia. Otherwise, Georgia would have gone the route of Ukraine to be a destroyed nation. And it's a very small nation. It can't absorb the damage that Ukraine has. The Russian-Georgian war would be over very quickly, and it would have been devastating for Georgia. So America lost Georgia because, again, go back to what I told you before, we don't have Georgian experts, we don't have Russian experts, and we don't have people that look out for the best interests of nations that we ostensibly call our friends. Russia, on the other hand, does have Georgian experts. Russia does have a deep desire to be friends with Georgia. They've been friends with Georgia forever. The Soviet Union incorporated Georgia. My wife is Georgian. She was educated in Moscow. She viewed herself as a Soviet, which means that she recognizes, you know, not just that she's Georgian, but that her friends, her relatives, her comrades, her colleagues are Russians. They're Ukrainians. They're Belarusians. They're Uzbek. They're Tatars. They're part of this great, conglomerate of peoples that, even though it's not the Soviet Union today, still should have a fraternal sense of belonging. The United States doesn't recognize that. We want to undo decades of history and social conditioning of economic reality simply to stick it to the Russians without any concern what the consequences to the Georgian people would be.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Scott, the other decision that the Biden administration has made was sending weapons to Saudi Arabia right now. They're talking about, the Biden administration has decided to send weapons, to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. Why they have decided to change their policy?
Because they're losing Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia's gone. Chinese came in, brokered a reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Iran, breaking the Sunni wall that was supposed to be confronting the Shia crescent. Saudi Arabia, you know, is BRICS. Iran's BRICS. If you're members of BRICS, you're talking about equitable cooperation designed to be to the economic and social and political benefit of both nations. You know, the United States, again, Dwight D. Eisenhower warned us about this. The military-industrial complex has taken over America. We only know one thing and one thing, and that's war. That's all we know. It's the only thing we can do. If we want to improve relations with nations, we promote war so we can sell them weapons. Look what we're doing with Georgia. You know, we'll help your military, but you need to go to war. If we can't, if you don't have one, we'll find one for you. You want to come and fight in Iraq for us, even though Georgia has nothing to do with Iraq? Come on, we'll help train you. Want to go to Afghanistan? You have even less to do in Afghanistan, but come on. Oh, wait, we need you to go to Ukraine and go to war instead of a second front. That's all we know. There's no constructive diplomacy out there, none. We have ceded diplomacy to the military. And so right now, in a very complicated and difficult situation, our only solution is to sell Saudi Arabia weapons, as if that's going to buy them. I think we've lost Saudi Arabia. We haven't recognized it yet. I don't think this sale of weapons is going to change anything.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me, and I hope to see you again next week, but that's up to God and the FBI. So
definitely, I guess.